Right now, there's 8 players between the pharmacy manufacturer and the patient. They take up about 35% of the total cost of a drug. They all get paid more money when we sell or administer a higher volume of more expensive drugs. It's opaque and it's built for the profit and benefit of the players in the distribution system, not for the benefit or the outcomes or the affordability of the patient.
Welcome to The Other 80. I'm Claudia Williams. Healthcare affordability is a number one pocketbook issue for most Americans, and drugs are a big part of that equation. We've spent our last 2 episodes diving deep on this issue. David Fagenbaum discussed how off-label use of drugs, most of which are already generic, could help treat 14,000 diseases with no known cure. Then Mark Cuban took us behind the curtain on his cost-plus drug strategy, which centers on direct contracting and disintermediating PBMs. If you missed either of those conversations, you've got to go back and listen. Both are posted as full video episodes on The Other 80's YouTube channel. While talking to David and Mark, I found myself pulling anecdotes and inspiration from a conversation I had last season with Paul Markovich. He's now the CEO of Ascendion, the parent company of Blue Shield of California, and he calls out healthcare affordability as not only a consumer dollars and cents issue, but also a growing challenge for the broader economy. And he gives compelling and frankly infuriating examples of how PBMs are blocking, not helping, the pursuit of more affordable drugs. Today, we are revisiting this conversation, which still ranks as the most listened to episode ever. So please re-welcome Paul Markovich to The Other 80. All right. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Claudia. How are you?
I'm doing good. Good. When we first met, I bet we never dreamed we'd be in this place, in this time, having this conversation.
Probably not. No, or at least not with headphones on.
No, not with headphones on. I always ask my guests, what's important to know about you?
Oh, what's important to know about me? I was born and raised in North Dakota. So at any point I can swing into my North Dakota accent. Oh yeah, you betcha. It's quite the deal. I actually say that because I mean, a lot happens in your formative years when in your upbringing. And of course, my parents instilled a lot of values in me, but there's a lot in, I think, that growing up in a small town in the upper Midwest, where humility and work ethic and just honesty and authenticity are really valued. And so I think those are values that are pretty dear to me, and they play out, I think, in how I try to do my work and how I try to live my life. So I think that's a pretty important part of it. I was fortunate enough to win a Rhodes Scholarship, and during that interview process, one of the questions I got asked was, the founder of this scholarship wanted to give it to people who would fight the world's fight. Mm. And so what's the world's fight to you? And that was a crystallizing question. I've always had this sense of obligation, responsibility to try to leave the world a better place than I found it in some way. And that question kind of crystallized it. And it's ultimately what led me into healthcare, because I feel like trying to transform a dysfunctional system into one that's worthy of our family and friends and sustainably affordable for everyone is the world's fight for me.
I thought you were going to talk about hockey.
Well, I did play a lot of hockey growing up in North Dakota. In fact, I just played yesterday. So just before my flight, I got a little ice time.
Great. Okay. We first connected in your office. Todd Park had introduced us. We were talking about this organization you had established and founded, Manifest MedX. And eventually I came on as the CEO and worked with you for several years. But I want to zoom back to the bigger vision, which is the vision of bringing health into the digital age, which you have talked about really passionately for a long time. And core to that is the idea that seamless data sharing is an enabler. And so I just want to first locate that idea. What does bringing health into the digital age mean to you?
Well, first of all, every American should have a real-time comprehensive digital health record. So everything about them that's been recorded in an electronic medical record of any sort from any provider, lab, pharmacy, any information that the health plan has should be gathered in one place, easy to access on their favorite device, and usable not only by them, but by treating clinicians or anyone else in the system that really has need and access for it. That's the digital foundation that I think needs to happen. And once you have that, automatically have it. You don't have to request it. You don't have to ping other people. You don't get a CD-ROM handed to you when you are looking for something that you can actually physically use. The physician isn't getting a 70-page PDF file attached to it saying, hey, we shared data. Like, what do they have to do? They don't have time to read that or to really do anything with it to identify, say, gaps in care or other next steps. So to me, that's the digital foundation. Once you have that, then you can start using all of these wonderful technical tools like generative artificial intelligence in ways that unlock the ability to truly personalize care and make it worthy of our family and friends.
Where are we on that?
Well, we're getting actually a lot closer, buddy. And thanks to you for all your efforts to get there. After a lot of struggles, we managed to get the state of California to mandate that hospitals and physician groups with more than 25 physicians are required to share that data with the health plan. So we announced, based on that, our own digital health record for our members in June of this year. So now our members can use their phone, their tablet, their favorite device. They can access all their medical information. We have about 50% of the data right now. We should be closer to 100% by the end of next year. But that mandate was a real breakthrough.
I just want to double click on something you and I both experienced, which is people dragging their feet, organizations dragging their feet on data sharing, not because they fundamentally disagreed with the goal, but because they didn't see the pathway to their business interests being supported by that. So a state mandate is an amazing way to break through. Do you still see that behavior and that set of things, or do you think we're beyond that?
Oh, no, I absolutely see that behavior, unfortunately. I think folks are realizing that it's probably going to be fruitless in the not too distant future, but there's still very intense resistance to it for multiple reasons, all business interest rooted. But what we really do need at the end of the day is a national mandate. And so one of the things we have been championing in Washington, D.C. is saying to both parties, and there's a lot of openness, it's a bipartisan issue, that every American should have access to their digital health records. Like, you don't have to, if you have a bank account or a credit card account, you don't have to run around and ask Nordstrom and Amazon for each piece of data from them and then collect it and put it in a spreadsheet. I mean, you get a monthly statement. And can you imagine the outcry if you didn't get a monthly statement for your credit card or your bank? This should just be automatic. It should be happening. It should be happening with every American. And I think there's a fair amount of agreement that's the case. And I think there's the will and the ability to do it. You know, with our political system, it'll take, everything takes a while. But I think we're eventually going to get there.
Drug prices are a huge pocketbook issue for many Americans and for the economy as a whole. What's broken about the drug market? Because most of us just take the script.
Right.
We go to the pharmacy. We're shocked at the price. We kind of don't understand the workings of the system.
Well, let's first talk about the distribution of drugs being broken, because there's multiple things, but that's top of the list. Right now, there's 8 players between the pharmacy manufacturer and the patient. They take up about 35% of the total cost of a drug, and they all get paid more money and make more profit when we sell or administer a higher volume of more expensive drugs. There's an expression, when all else fails, bet on self-interest. So all of these players have been pursuing their financial self-interest by ensuring that we sell and administer a higher volume of more expensive drugs. It is structurally inflationary. It's opaque and it's built for the profit and benefit of the players in the distribution system, not for the benefit or the outcomes or the affordability of the patient. And so not surprisingly, you know, we just had this amazing inflation rate in pharmaceuticals. And you have situations like the one I described when we announced our initiative, which is there's a generic prostate cancer drug called abiraterone. And it, on average, costs $3,000 a month. This was last year. And we managed to negotiate through a nonprofit coalition we helped form called Civica, a $160 a month version.
Wow.
And it's a generic. So it is the exact same compound. And we went to our pharmacy benefit manager and said, isn't this great news? Let's go sell the $160 version. And they said, no, For 5 months, they said no. And they finally, after a whole lot of pressure.
Tell us, I mean, you're the client. You're purchasing right. from them. What are the mechanics of them saying no?
Oh, it feels it's just ridiculous things. You know, so it's the parent company that owns the pharmacy benefit manager and the specialty pharmacy that distributes it. And then they say, well, we have this contract that's exclusive to this drug and we can't. It's like, what do you mean? You're the parent. You 100% own both these entities. You can do whatever you want here. And so they came up with things like that. I don't think they said that the dog ate their homework, but there were things, I mean, just not credible reasons for not doing it. And ultimately they said, well, you can distribute the drug through your own special, we'll grant you permission to distribute this ourselves, but we're only distributing the $3,000 version. So can you imagine? We're the customer. They're theoretically supposed to be helping us make drugs more affordable. We show up with this more affordable version and they refuse to offer it. And so it's things like that that are just completely messed up in the system.
I was at the Health Evolution Summit event when Mark Cuban spoke about this using much more colorful language, I would say.
Well, I'm not as colorful as Mark. I appreciate him and what he's doing, but I'm not as colorful as he is.
His point of view was, we don't really need these middle people. And it's interesting with Civica, I don't think you're answering that question in a holistic way. But if there's a middleman whose main role is to create inflation, that doesn't seem like a very useful.
No. Well, and that's the whole basis of our model and what we announced last year and what's going live for us on January 1st is we're not using the middlemen. We are going directly to the pharmacy manufacturers and negotiating. We said, we don't want rebates. We don't want fees. We don't have kickbacks. We just need to know, like, whatever you collect in actual revenue from the pharmacy benefit manager or thereabouts, that just, we will pay you that directly for the drug, and then we're done. And then we'll go back and create our own distribution system where everyone in the system is just getting rewarded for providing good service, getting the right drug to the right person at the right time. Amazon doesn't get paid based on the price of what's in the box that they send
imagine?
To your house.
Oh, yeah. That would be very scary.
Well, that's effectively what happens in this system.
Yeah.
Like wholesalers and distributors, for example, get paid on a piece of the price of the drug. And so that's why I'm saying everybody's got a finger in the pocket, which is also why our announcement a couple weeks ago about Humira was so big. Because right now, I mean, Humira is even today the single drug that we spend the most money on.
So, for those who don't know, what's Humira?
So Humira is an injectable drug that helps with pain like rheumatoid arthritis, that sort of thing. It came off patent in like January of 2023. So it's been off patent for almost 2 years. Now, theoretically, what happens when you come off patent is that any other pharmacy manufacturer can produce the same drug at whatever price they want to. And so if it's a chemical compound, then it becomes a generic drug. If it's got any organic material in it, then it's a biosimilar in terms of how it's produced. So in this case, biosimilars became available in January 2023. But Humira maintained like a 90%+ market share. So what we did is based on our model, based on going directly and negotiating directly for just a straight price, today Humira costs after rebates, the list price is like $6,000 or $7,000 or $8,000 or something like that. But after all the rebates, it costs about $2,100 a month. So after a lot of noise, the pharmacy benefit managers, the big three, finally offered their own biosimilars for anywhere between like $1,000 and $1,300 a month. You know, like, hey, you know, 2 years later now we're doing our own and now we have biosimilars. Well, we negotiated a biosimilar and announced it at $525 with Fresenius Kabi. And so everyone's out there saying, I've got this great deal from my pharmacy benefit manager because I get these really big rebates and I'm at the end of the day spending $2,100 a month. And oh, by the way, it's often the case that the copayment that the member pays is based on the list price. So it's like on the $6,000 or $7,000 version, there's something like 10 to 15% of the time, members will pay a copay that's more than the manufacturer nets for the price of the drug.
Wow.
Yeah. And you can imagine that, like with our abiraterone example, if the list price is $3,000 and you have a a copayment of, say, 10%, that's a $300 copay when we were paying $160 for the drug to the manufacturer.
I always bristle a little when people talk about having consumer skin in the game. Because imagine a consumer trying to, A, figure out what drug prices even meant.
Right.
And B, there's no negotiation. So we need our health plans. We need our employers. We need the government to play this role of calling foul and basically figuring this out. The federal government has started to do this with a subset of drugs, negotiating for the first time ever.
Yep.
The fact that we can't negotiate in Medicare is a weird blip of the way the Part D was developed in the first place. And you can you can imagine the conversations where the drug companies were like, we're good with this as long as you can't negotiate.
Right.
What do you hope is on the agenda of the next administration around drug affordability?
Well, the reality is we are facing a huge affordability crisis, a fiscal crisis. Right now, even though our economy is running at pretty much at or near full employment, we have record fiscal deficits. So something like 7% of our gross domestic product, almost $2 trillion a year in deficits. And our collective debt as a country is now at levels near where Greece was in 2009 when they had their major fiscal crisis. And some of the people stopped lending, some countries stopped lending to them or had to restructure their debt. So at some point, we're going to have to deal with that. Even our dysfunctional political system is going to have to deal with that. And the problem they're going to run into is that for all the political talk about getting rid of wasteful spending in Washington, over half of what we spend every year is for Medicare, Medicaid, subsidies for the Affordable Care Act, and Social Security. And in fact, the second biggest, after that collective set of stuff, the second biggest item that we spend money on right now is interest on our debt, followed by defense spending. And then there's everything else. And if you literally stop spending, it took everything else that we spend on other than defense, interest, and these mandatory payment programs, you'd still have a deficit. So they're going to have to tackle healthcare costs. And I think some of what's going on right now with this, what I call the beginning of the big squeeze in Medicare Advantage, is related to that. We cannot keep spending on this program the way that we are. We need to bring the spending down. They may do it in different ways. They may have different value sets about what they're, you know, how they think about different programs like Medicaid, but they're all going to have to deal with it.
California was one of the only states that put in place legislative controls on the rate of cost growth. I'm curious, A, how you think that's going, and B, do you think that's a model for the country?
We were big supporters of this when it came out and still are. And the reason is that I believe necessity is the mother of invention. And right now there's just no pressure on the entire industry to say, figure out how to be more productive, figure out how to be more efficient. And what almost everybody in the entire value chain, whether it's health plans or hospitals or all the way through, they want to explain why healthcare is so expensive and why there's this inflation rate, as if that absolves them of any responsibility to make it different. And so what I really want is accountability, and a level of accountability that just doesn't exist yet in our industry, to say, hey, we own this. I went and saw a CEO of a hospital here a few months ago, and I happened to go to the wrong building, and I ended up in the emergency room waiting area instead of the administrative office, which was right next door. And so I had to wait for about 15 minutes until someone kind of showed me where I was supposed to be. And I was sitting there and I watched the entire time, just observed what was going on in the emergency room. Went up and saw the CEO, and they're like, well, you know, we just can't, this is just what it costs, and this is why it costs so much. And I said, you know, I just sat in your emergency room and I watched two nurses and a doctor sit at a terminal for 15 minutes typing. You can't tell me there aren't opportunities to improve productivity when we know, like based on all kinds of surveys, that there's all this administrative inefficiency. Prior authorization is one of them in the system, that if we were to sit down and get really serious about it, we could save a lot of money just in very simple improvements, automation, digitization, ambient dictation is one of those things you're probably going to hear more about from us. We're piloting that successfully right now, and doctors love it. It's saving them a couple of hours a day because they don't have to do anything other than check their for the accuracy of what was captured in their voice while they were having a conversation with a patient. So there's huge opportunities to do that. But I think what we're still getting right now, Claudia, is we're in that, you know, whatever the seven stages of grief are. We're still in the denial phase right now. There's still this can't be true. Let me explain why it's so expensive. So we will eventually get over that. But right now, I'm encouraged by it. I think it can be a model for the country. But we need the industry response to be, I would say, better than it has been so far.
Yeah. That brings us to something I've been thinking about here at this conference, where Be Bold is in the title. I just feel a little jaded about that term. And it's one of the reasons I made a move to really focus on the underlying drivers of health. I've been in rooms with you where you've been very bold and very brave. It's easy to take a leadership path in health, which is the path of least resistance, where you won't get complaints. And that can never be the way we achieve hard change. Mm-hmm. Take a step back from your own self and observe, how is it that you've been able to be brave and bold? And what advice would you give emerging leaders about that?
Well, for me, it all starts in who you want to be and what you want to accomplish. So going back to fighting the world's fight, it is professionally my motivation is to create a healthcare system that's worthy of our family and friends and sustainably affordable for everyone. And I carry that with me. And so when something's not meeting that standard, then it needs to be addressed in some way. And so I think when you get clear with yourself about what matters to you, then I think the solutions and the steps that you need to take, the role that you need to play, becomes pretty clear. And then after that, I ask people when they get hesitant, when sometimes things are simple but difficult. Even this pharmacy benefit manager substitution, like, this wasn't a complicated decision to make, but wow, is it difficult to pull off? And are there risks involved in it? And do those risks potentially threaten my job if they don't go well? Yes, all that's true. But I'll ask people, what would you do if you weren't afraid? Mm. What would you do if you weren't afraid? And then it becomes clarifying. You take the fear away. You look at what you do. Okay, if I wasn't afraid of any consequence, whatever it is that I'm worried about, like I'd lose my job and financially I'd be, you know, have some hardship or whatever it happens to be. Okay, well, just what if that wasn't a problem? Rather than really admit to ourselves that we're not going forward because I'm afraid for me, you start coming up with other reasons to rationalize why you shouldn't be so bold and pursue it. So to me, it's like, get clear on your purpose and make that your guiding North Star and just stick to it. And then when you're thinking about what to do, ask yourself that question. What would I do if I wasn't afraid?
And what's beautiful about that, it doesn't will away the fear. The fear can still be there.
Oh, yeah. No, it is.
But it allows us to inhabit our best selves in moving the goals forward that we know need to happen. I'm sorry it's been so long since we last saw each other, and such a pleasure to talk with you. And I can't wait to see your announcement on stage.
Oh, the pleasure was truly mine. Thanks, Claudia.
I hope you found this three-part series on drugs and drug prices as eye-opening as I have. In this episode, Paul breaks down the complexity, but also opacity, of a system built for profit over patients. And in previous episodes, both Mark Cuban and David Faigenbaum offered compelling solutions. One thing is clear. It is time for real, actionable change. Whether that happens through plans demanding a working market, billionaires offering a disruptive alternative, or nonprofits making creative use of what we already have. This podcast was created by me, Claudia Williams. My podcast producer is Avery Moore Kloss. Check out the show notes for more information on Paul Markovich and his work. There is more information on my background, this podcast, and our guests on our website, www.theother80.com. Until next time, I'm Claudia Williams.